Okay, thanks for coming, everyone. We'll get started. There's probably still a few people coming in, but you know, we'll make a start anyway. You're here to see ERM capturing the upside, so if you thought you were somewhere else, now's your chance to leave. Speaker today is Brett Riley. Brett's a principal of Finity Consulting. He has 10 years' experience in the general insurance industry, and before that worked in the funds management industry for a few years, and has been an actuary now for over 10 years. At Finity, Brett leads the enterprise risk management practice. There he's worked on a variety of assignments for a number of Australian and UK insurers and corporates as well, across both basically the broad spectrum of the general insurance operations. Brett's also the appointed actuary for one licensed general insurer. And I'm very pleased to see someone actually talking about enterprise risk management and talking about the concept of using it to add value, not just reduce risks. So hand over to you, Brett.
Okay, thanks, Zach. Good afternoon. Welcome to my presentation on capturing the upside with ERM. It seems that everyone has something to say about ERM. You know, there's a lot of people talking about it, a lot of presentations. Unfortunately, that probably will mean there's a little bit of overlap with my presentation. If some of you have been to the earlier slots on ERM, I'll try and give my own sort of spin on it, my own message that's coming out of it. As Zach said, I'm trying to draw out some of the commercial benefits. What's the upside in using these techniques rather than just seeing them in a traditional mitigation setting? I think hindsight bias is something to be aware of. It's easy to stand up here 1 year on from everything that's happened with the GFC and sort of say they should have done this, they should have done that. Not many of the people who are talking about this now were saying those things 2 years ago. So I suppose all I'm trying to bring out is some of the lessons maybe that we've learned. Apologies, my paper did go up on the website a bit late, so please I encourage you to log on and have a look, download it. It does have a little bit of a GI bias, but as you'll see from the case studies, that is fairly slight. So for those who are here who aren't GI practitioners, I don't think that's an issue. So what are the key points, I suppose, in summary that I'm just trying to draw out? For most of the industries we work in, insurers, banks, health insurers, general life insurers, they need to do risk management. It's part of their regulation. So they've got to have the framework. They've got to do it. They tend to go through the motions. When you need to do something as compliance, as regulation, you just do the minimum. You just do what you've got to do. And my argument is if you maybe for a small incremental effort, you can get a lot more commercial benefit by actually really living and breathing this stuff and using it. I've got no silver bullet, so if you're here hoping for that, sorry, I don't have that. But these are just my insights on maybe some things companies can focus on, based partly from my reading, partly from experience. I've got a few slides to go on, so I'll skip over as much as I can quickly, have a look at the paper. No reference to the Rumsfeld quote in this presentation, no reference to perfect storms, so move right along. So I'll give a brief introduction, then I'll lead into what I consider are six areas that financial services companies, this is a generalisation, but six areas that I think general insurance companies, general financial services companies in general, can focus on to maybe capture some of the upside that ERM offers in a commercial sense. Those six areas are risk culture, management oversight, risk appetites, strategy, planning, and information and reporting. Following the discussion of those, I'll run through four case studies and then wrap up with conclusions and we'll have some discussions and questions. So I think I've covered the aim. I just find it useful, particularly people who maybe are fairly new to ERM, it's useful with definitions. And I've just stated a definition of risk that I like to use. You get some that say risk is exposure to loss or injury, or exposure, or risk is volatility of outcome, which are useful in their own way. I like to think of it as a likelihood of failing to meet objectives, because if you have objectives, particularly within a firm that are internally consistent across business units and the corporation, between different people, if it's all well set, well structured, well articulated, it's a good generic definition that can apply to all. I've also given, I suppose, my own working definition of a VRM. I suppose the other two that are out there that I like are the COSO definition and the CAS definitions. I do find them a little bit verbose, and I find when you talk to people it's a bit hard to convey in a practical sense the thrust of, you know, what it's about. So for me, ERM is a generation of superior performance in a firm through the use of better information and improved management of all risks which threaten the achievement of objectives. And again, the two key things, I've highlighted some things in bold that are important there, but the two things impacting on the flavour of this presentation are the superior performance and achievement of objectives. There's a fairly simple graphic of the six areas that I outlined before. It's not rocket science. I suppose all I'm trying to convey there is that there's interconnections. Maybe a better way to present it might have been some overlapping circles. At the top, for example, you'll see that risk culture and management, there's a very strong overlap there. So I'll lead off with risk culture. And I did that one first because that was intentional. I think that is, in some ways, the most important one, because if the risk culture of a firm is poor, the other ones will generally be poor. And I think the most fundamental part of a sound risk culture is it needs to be sponsored by the CEO. Because whatever the governance structures you have in place in a firm, the role of a board, the role of other executives, the roles of executive or board committees, the CEO generally is a very dominant person in the firm and they need to be on board with this. Communication, I suppose, takes three levels, and three things I'd say about that is maybe the first step is that the CEO needs to convince the other managers in the firm of its importance, or alternatively needs to have been convinced, and they as a group need to be on message. Secondly, there should be communication to all staff, in my opinion, coming from the CEO, because if the managers by that stage are on board, they won't be undermining what the CEO is trying to communicate. And then finally, there's an ongoing communication to staff, reinforcing the message. I mentioned there the treatment of stars. You can't have different rules for different people. You know, in an investment bank, it might be traders. In an insurer, it might be key underwriters. They can't be seen to be getting away with things. They need to be held accountable as well. Remuneration structures, I won't talk about that, but that is obviously very topical at the moment with APRA investigating that, and a lot of people here and abroad are looking into maybe some of the flaws in structures that led to some of the problems, particularly in the US. But that's important in the scheme of things. You need to, as I mentioned before, you need to hold people accountable. You need strong performance objectives that people know where they stand and if they do or don't deliver on what they're meant to do. There's a few other things listed in the paper. One I'll just draw out. I'll mention the references, some of the papers that I've referenced in writing my paper. One that was published recently is from Dayton and others. It was presented to the Institute and faculty last month. And they draw out four barriers, four hurdles to embedding a sound risk culture. The first is the inherent clash between executive and non-executive directors and overcoming that, given that one draws a lot of its income from that position. The other group, it's a smaller part of their stake and they'd be more concerned about their... Well, both are concerned about their reputations, but they're coming from different perspectives. The second barrier to implementation is the centralised-decentralised argument. How much of it is actually deployed down into the business units and the sort of the duality of the role of that person. Do they report to their business unit manager? Do they report to the central risk management function? How is that managed? The third barrier is theory versus practice. You know, a lot of theoretical concepts in risk management were being put forth a couple of years ago. A lot of people are now questioning the theory. And it's a question of how maybe some of the modellers respond in that space. And then finally is the relationships with our rating agencies and regulators. A lot of this is being pushed on firms, for want of a better word, by regulators and rating agencies. It's seen as compliance. And I suppose this is the theme of my paper. It's getting over the hurdle of we have to do it versus it's worth doing. So what should the CEO say? I think the message can be summarised in those points. The idea that all staff need to own risk, they need to have responsibilities. It can be quite easy for a firm to trip up at a low level. One thing I remember seeing when I was visiting IAG's Sydney offices, I always find I get my tongue twisted with IAG or AIG, make sure I don't get those mixed up in the current climate. Visiting IAG in Sydney probably a year or two ago, catching a lift up to see someone, and posted there inside the lift was something like, treat your password like your toothbrush, don't share it with anyone. Just the idea of just reinforcing that message and giving the idea to all people that come through the business, come through the building, it's, it matters. Every person matters. Business as usual, you know, it's not a once a year exercise, it's not the risk management department's exercise. Everyone needs to take responsibility. Everyone says they do this, but how well do they do it? It's, I suppose, as much as anything, a self-examination. And the last point, I suppose, I just want to summarise a few of those points there, is it's about changing perceptions of risk management. It's not internal audit. It's not compliance. Maybe it's a bit of a challenge to try and lift it to the same sort of prestige as a revenue generator, like an underwriting team or a trading desk in a bank. But it can't be seen as the poor second, third, fourth cousin. It needs to have a higher profile. I'll move on to the second of my six areas, management oversight. I won't talk too much about that slide. It's fairly self-explanatory, except to add that it overlaps substantially with culture. And I suppose ultimately risk culture is the understanding the way we do things around here, but also executing, having good execution by management. I've put a slide up there. It's my, I suppose, take on the different risk types in a firm. Other people will present it differently. We've seen this already in some earlier sessions. So I won't go into a lot of detail. The small font, I apologise for that. In my rush to get this finished, I can get the font larger than what it is. The key thing I suppose I want to draw out is this was written for a general insurer, but I think it could apply to any insurer, and I think it would take too much modification to make it look something similar for a bank. There's four categories of risk. The top left corner, you've got insurance risk, so that's something, it's about the core business of an insurer, the underwriting, the pricing, the claims runoff, the occurrence risk, everything about that core underwriting function. The top right box is other financial risks, so your market, your credit, liquidity, asset and liability management. And then bottom left, you've got operational risk, and the bottom right, strategic risk. Some people put those together. For instance, Basel II, they don't distinguish between those two categories. I like to think of operational risk as these are the risks we run if it's business as usual, whereas your strategic risks are these are the risks of disruptions to our business. The allocation of the groups isn't critical. At the end of the day, you need some system that allocates it, as long as everything gets covered. For instance, someone might argue execution of our strategy should be part of our core function because we should be doing that continuously. So that should be an operational risk rather than strategic. For me, who cares? As long as it's classified and everyone knows how it's going to be treated. I've got a further distinction between what I call quantified and non-quantified risks. Quantified are the ones where there's generally plentiful data, it's well analysed, quite well understood. I suppose in the industries we work in, it's pretty well modelled. That's sort of our strength, our key area. And the other dimension to it is when it hits, it generally hits the financial accounts immediately when there is an event in that area. For the non-quantified risks, the data's imperfect, more imperfect. Actuaries haven't been involved for a long time, and something can happen and it won't affect the accounts, it won't affect the P&L, the balance sheet, possibly for several periods. Maybe it might have some reputational damage, it's not going to affect your profit and loss maybe in this period, but once you start bleeding customers, you'll see it next year and the year after. The key message, I suppose, getting back onto the message of the paper and the presentation, is it's a tool. It's a framework for thinking about different types of risk and for firms to think about maybe where they're deficient. Some may focus above the line. You know, they're quant type, technically driven people. They've got their DFA, their stochastic models, and they like running those and they understand those, but maybe they're neglecting something below the line. Alternatively, you may have some firms who view risk management in a traditional sense. It's operational risk management. It's the bottom left-hand corner. So the point I'm trying to draw out is management need to have an awareness an interest in and be across all of those risks. I'll comment on a few of these points about time management oversight. A useful line, I can't remember where I heard it, hope for the best, plan for the worst. A key lesson from the financial crisis is, the key question, was the risk management poor or were people unlucky? Now, this was something that was discussed in a few earlier sessions. I think it's probably a bit of both, but you need to know your exposures. I mean, that's fundamentally what this is about. In a general insurance sense, if you know your PML, you know your exposure, and that's, you know, with a fairly extreme return period. That's what firms need to do, and I suppose I'd question whether maybe some of the firms that have been hit hard by the financial crisis knew their exposures. It's about being prepared, knowing those exposures. To do ERM well, you need a centralised risk management function in some form. It will depend on the firm. Some are larger and can have a larger team, a specialist CRO. In other firms, it might be something that's covered by the CFO, but there needs to be some level of centralised oversight. I suppose the last 2 points I just try and make there is scepticism is healthy. Be sceptical. Be sceptical about what your risk managers are telling you. Be sceptical about what the business is telling you. Get multiple points of view. You know, run different models. Get model output, quantitative output. Get expert opinion. Look at the two. Understand the differences. I'll move on to the third of the six areas that I'm going to address, which is risk appetite. Why have one? It allows faster responses to the environment. If something develops in the environment, you know where you're placed, you know what sort of risks you're going to take on. It can allow the building of efficient risk portfolios. You don't want to be taking on too much risk and not getting a reward for it. Operational risk is case in point. You don't get a reward for that, so you want to try and minimise that as best you can. It allows internal consistency. It comes back to the link to communication that I said before. You can communicate throughout the firm a consistent message. This is what we do, and this is how much risk we're going to take. Like a lot of things in ERM, there's no hard and fast way to do it, no single way to do it. But for me, these are the sort of things that you want to be addressing. Something about failure. So a maximum probability of insolvency, ruin, impairment, however you want to define it. So that's going to be capital-driven. You'll want something around a maximum acceptable volatility of earnings at risk, some measure like that, because that's where the business is going to be interested. They're not generally worried about a 1 in 200-year event. You probably want other limits, maybe some of the harder-to-quantify risks around things like regulatory action, reputational damage, HR, human safety, so maybe some comments on those. And finally, I think it just helps to qualitatively talk about this is what we do, this is where we're going to play. You know, we've got expertise in market risk, we've got expertise in credit risk, or in the general insurance example, these are the segments of the market we're going to operate in. A couple of other related concepts, risk capacity, which is essentially the maximum amount you could take on. So if you were had a very strong risk appetite. There's limitations, obviously, in how much you can write, in terms of how much capital you've got, how much access, what your access to future capital, further capital is, versus how much you can build your book up in terms of a minimum amount of capital that's required. And also, I suppose, down the chain, risk limits. You know, you want to set limits for underwriters, credit positions, market risk positions, and you want to close the loop and loop those back up to the high-level view. A couple of comments on implementation. In theory, the board should set it and say to management, this is how it is. I think in practice, management would be expected to draft it and get the board to sign off on it, and there's probably a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing there. I'm a strong supporter in using DFA or internal models to aggregate risk and quantify it as much as possible. I think it helps to document where you are now, and it sort of breaks down the problem into two components. Rather than trying to set out and sort of say, this is how we're going to document it, and this is where we want to be, how about you start by saying, this is what our profile looks like, let's write that down. And once you've got the framework, then think about how you want to move things around and whether you want to take more risk, less, more of this type, and so on. You want to keep people accountable. I've mentioned that. I suppose another thing for firms is just to be aware of whether they tend to be aggressive or conservative on this. A lot of firms tend to go to one extreme, and there's probably a healthy position in the middle. Move on to the fourth in my list of six, I think I'm up to, which is strategy. I suppose it can vary. I mean, a lot of my comments are generalisations, but I suppose each firm should ask whether they have articulated their vision and their objectives as well as they could have. And I think at the end of the day, it's what's our competitive advantage? Why are we in the businesses we're in? What advantage do we have being in this place? Is it around brand? Is it around scale? Is it around underwriting expertise? That's a question that needs to be addressed. The strategy will follow, but that's closely, basically, directly linked to risk management. It's not that one follows the other. They've got to be interconnected, and one's going to influence the other. I suppose following on from that, there's a key issue around diversification versus core competencies. You want to build, you know, modern portfolio theory, even though a lot of people say it's, as a concept, is disputed. People generally accept that diversification is a good thing. Warren Buffett's in the past said that it's not. But I don't think you want to diversify just for the sake of it. You want to diversify where you've got strength, where your core competencies lie. I've got a couple of examples there on the screen. The first is a general insurer. The primary competency is underwriting, pricing and claims management. It's that whole underwriting function. They may play in different markets, you know, maybe various classes of business, different distribution channels, different regions of Australia, maybe overseas. Wherever they play, they want to build up a fairly diverse book of individual risks. Once they've got that, there's going to be some unacceptable risks. The traditional example is an accumulation risk for catastrophe exposure. Reinsurance is an efficient way to lay that off. That's an example of playing to your strength. Don't go and do something that's maybe outside your core competency. One of the examples I come to in a moment is AIG, and I don't have the answers, I don't know rightly or wrongly, but I pose a question. Did they have the competency to be running a CDS book? Don't know. I've used the example there of also investment. You know, general insurance is a bit different to likes of, say, superannuation, life insurance, because you don't run some of the same risks that have linkages, the long-term liabilities with linkages to certain types of market risk. So it does become more optional whether you're going to take certain risks. I suppose there's two dimensions. One is growth risks. You know, the growth asset classes, equities, property, are insurers going to operate in that space? That's ultimately a question for their risk appetite. And then secondly, active management. You know, are you going to employ an active fund manager to run your portfolio? Do you have the internal skills? Do you trust the external manager that you're going to delegate that role to? Or do you sort of say it's too much of a distraction, we're not going to use up our risk budget in that way, let's focus on our core competency of underwriting? Some practical examples of some of the issues. I've shown there a different representation of the risk management cycle from Bueller and others. It's a little bit different from the normal sort of risk management process that's presented in standards like 4360, but I think it fits the theme of my paper, so that's why I've included it. I won't go through all the detail on the slide, but essentially they're saying, firstly, identify and understand your major risks, understand your business. Decide which risks are natural, where does your advantage lie. Determine your capacity and appetite for risk, I've spoken about that. Embed risk in all decisions and processes. And then align governance and organisation around risk. Maybe I would have started with that one, around the governance, but at the end of the day, it's a cycle. And you want to go through those steps. A few other practical issues. You want to seek natural counterparties. They may be internal to the firm, you know, internal hedges. They may be external. A classic example going back 20, 30 years was the rise of interest rate swaps. You know, you had certain borrowers who had a competitive advantage borrowing fixed rate. Some had an advantage borrowing floating rate. investment banks got together, took some of the difference, but everyone came out better. So sometimes there are natural counterparties for some of the people who work in our industries. Sometimes it might be harder to find. I've shown there the example of an internal captive for reinsurer. It's pretty well established for large insurance groups that operate around the world. They generally have a captive that will buy the external reinsurance for the group and provide internal cover for the various subsidiaries around the world to protect them down to a retention they would find acceptable and the local regulator would find acceptable. And that's a classic example of efficient risk-taking rather than each company going out and buying its own reinsurance. And it's about finding those internal hedges and that internal, keeping that premium and that benefit inside the firm. I've floated another example there, which is maybe more along the lines of Zach's line of thinking about transfer of risk, about would it work if a lender's mortgage insurer took a short position in equities? Is there too much basis risk? The idea that it's bad for an LMI to invest in property. Most would tend to invest fairly conservatively, cash and bonds. But because LMI is a strong concentration that's tied to the economy, property prices, and by extension, you could argue, the share market, could they take a modest short position in equities so that when things turn down, it's a partial hedge? I don't know, I wouldn't advocate a strong short position, but it's something that would need to be managed closely and I think managed tactically. If the share market turned down, I suppose at the moment, if you had implemented this a few years ago, the share market's taken a hit. Claims for LMI haven't come through yet. If I had that position, I'd probably be closing it out now. But it's something to bear in mind, given that, something that could be analysed. Just thinking outside the square. Another point there, keep pursuing new risk transfer mechanisms. Securitisation's got a bad name, what's happened with the whole subprime debacle. But fundamentally, securitisation is a sound concept. We haven't run into problems here, provided it's not abused and it's the regulation of it is sound. It's still a good risk transfer mechanism. And I think risk managers and actuaries and our industry as a whole should continue pursuing such mechanisms. On to the fifth of my 6 points, better planning. I think business planning in a risk management sense is something that is severely underutilised. That's my personal opinion. It doesn't need to be technical. As I said before, I like DFA models. You want to do sort of robust, complex modelling, but it's a hard model, hard concept to sell to business managers. The plan is something that everyone's got a stake in, everyone contributes to, if the planning process is done well. And it's something that's maybe not the ideal. Maybe you aspire to have a fully blown DFA model that covers all the risks in the firm, but it's a huge improvement with not a lot of effort from where a lot of companies already are. So on that basis, use scenario analysis and push the people in those positions looking at their businesses to think away from the mean. When people plan, they tend to hug the middle. They sort of think 5% growth in risk count, premiums down 5%, up 5%. Really shake it. And I think the GFC sort of gives us a bit of an opportunity to say to people, look at what we've just been through. You have people who've been hit by their equity exposure, hit by claims coming through maybe on catastrophes, hit by discount rate effects on their liability valuations. All these things that you didn't think would hit you at once, they have. Think how bad it could get and stress it. Another point I'd add there is you need to manage time pressures. Planning tends to be quite a fraught process. People are under pressure to turn things around. So maybe this dimension to it could be done outside the normal time frame and hooked in when the main planning process happens. Following on from that, so you want to plan responses for the unexpected. Business continuity plans are the classic case. A well-prepared BCP gives you a huge competitive advantage. If your competitors haven't got one and they're not ready, in the interim while everyone is down, you're likely going to be able to respond better. and you're probably going to be on your feet sooner. So it shouldn't be seen. It comes back to the point Zach made introducing me and what I've been trying to say. It's not just about mitigation and managing your downside. It's also spotting the opportunity that you can be better positioned and use this as a tool to extract a bit of commercial advantage. I think that's the point about you want to, in selling it to the business and the CEO. It's focus on the commercial benefit. I'm a strong supporter of preparing loss scenarios to breach thresholds. I suppose ultimately you need to think about the severity and probability of things happening. But to get people in the business thinking about it, put the probability aspect to one side. Think about the severity. Just sort of say, this is, from a capital perspective, we're currently running with a capital position that's twice our MCR. We can't go below 120%. We target not going below 130%. That 70% buffer represents X million dollars, which translates to the profit before tax of so much, and then think about how you could actually generate a loss of that magnitude. Start to think about how, what are the key thresholds, the key pressure points. I'll skim over this one quickly because we're running out of time. Last point, better information and reporting. I suppose information is the lifeblood of ERM. If you don't have good information flowing to the right people, you're in a bit of a bind. I've made the point there about taking a fundamentalist approach. I'm not advocating blowing things up. What I am saying is understand the business, get to the fundamentals, understand processes. Because I suppose with actuaries, we are statistical. We do tend to look at what's happened in the past. But I think there's an advantage from actually mapping business processes and understanding the risk that comes from that mapping. And as I understand it, that's generally the direction that the risk margins task force of GIPC is going down in terms of a better framework for quantifying risk margins for insurance liabilities. So what I'm proposing is a generalisation of that. Four case studies. I might skip the AIG one, given we've heard about it before. I suppose the thing I'd say in introducing these is there's strengths and weaknesses of every firm, so I'm not on the payroll of Goldman Sachs or TXU or whatever they're called now. And equally, I'm not out here to bash AIG and NAB. It's just reporting on a few things that are in the public domain about experiences these firms have had. And I'd be interested at the end to see if anyone agrees, disagrees with any of the points I make. There are a few cases of success stories in the public domain. People sort of guard this as a bit of a competitive advantage in terms of the specifics. So it's hard to track down some things, but at the end I'll tell you where I've sort of got the information for these. Goldman Sachs is, I think, pretty well regarded as one of the better performing investment banks recently. It's come out of the subprime crisis better than most. One of two out of the five bulge bracket Wall Street firms that's still standing independently, although it is a proper bank now. About 10 years ago, they changed direction about the time they floated. They took on a lot more trading risk as opposed to a traditional investment bank, the traditional sort of investment banking advisory work. I suppose that demonstrates their strong risk culture. They're prepared to take positions and back them. Their subprime experience, late 2006, they looked at some key indicators that suggested that things weren't looking good. Maybe it was luck, maybe it was skill, I don't know. But they started hedging aggressively into early 2007. And at that stage, there were plenty of willing buyers willing to take the other side of the hedge. Some people, I suppose, one criticism that some people have raised was there a conflict? Because at the same time, their trading desk was hedging its position, the investment bank was still underwriting and promoting CDOs and mortgage-backed securities. And there's a question, do they have a duty to their customers in that respect? The firm has basically said, no, they don't. Each business unit is held accountable, has to do the best it can. They didn't mislead anyone. They told them what they had to do. They have strong protections in place. They consider capital at risk, strong investment in training, and they have an open risk culture where you can discuss risk issues. A lot of my material on this was taken from the Bueller article, and they identify four key things that they think differentiates Goldman Sachs from others in their market. The first is strong quant skills. They got into that probably more than other banks did back in the 80s, early 80s, and hired some pretty impressive PhDs in that area. I suppose the reputation of those people has been damaged, but they did add a lot to the business back in those days. They had good oversight. Back in 94, in the bond market sell-off, the business was hurt pretty badly. So there's a lot stronger oversight of the business from that point onwards. Even though they're no longer a partnership, there's a strong partnership heritage. A lot of the senior executives still have stakes in the business after they leave the firm. So there's an interest in the long-term sustainability of the business and strong business principles.
Brett, do you want to see if there's only 5 minutes?
Only 5 minutes.
See if there's any questions before we do
that? Yeah, I might just do this TXU one quickly and then I'll wrap up. TXU was a Texas electricity utility. Deregulation occurred in 2002. A year later, they were in a bit of trouble. Share price had fallen sharply, high level of debt. They restructured and they said our two key principles are we're going to retain risk where we have a competitive advantage and we're going to actively manage our risk capacity. So they took a contrarian position compared to most around wholesale power prices. A lot of people were advising them, hedge the exposure, don't take the power, don't take the price exposure. They went against that advice and scaled back their business, so they divested. I don't know about you, I think my electricity, possibly my gas as well, is with TXU Australia. They had an operation here. So they sold that off. They outsourced things like billing and certain functions, built up a lot of capacity, sold down debt, took a lot more price exposure. Maybe they were lucky, maybe it was skill, but from about 2004 onwards, power prices surged and they did very well and they were sold through a leveraged buyout a couple of years ago. AIG, as I said, I've covered. NAB, all I was going to say there was two things happened. The home side debacle sort of blew up in 2001, $4 billion loss. The upshot from that was not a severe fallout. A couple of years later, the FX options losses, smaller loss, but because a lot of the underlying problems hadn't been fixed, there was massive ramifications. That material was taken largely from the CPD course. Here's the conclusions. No single approach. Approaches are going to revolve. You want to do this for commercial reasons. I've mentioned the six key benefits, and the potential benefits have been spoken about before. Lower capital, lower cost of capital, better risk return outcomes. I'll take some questions.
Andrew Wexing, thanks very much, Brett. I agree with practically all of that. Except one point which I thought was very, very provocative and I profoundly disagree with, and I think it's really important. You suggested that it might be a valid thing to do for a company to take a short position in equities. Now, I can't think of anything more frightening, more dreadful than the idea that we've got these companies who run insurance companies or ice cream factories or whatever, and they start trying to manage the share price. Now, managing your share price is not a valid objective for a company. They manage the business. The market decides what it's worth, and it really is a bad idea for us to, I mean, I know that we're going to use the share price as some sort of proxy for the company. Can we please, as risk managers, take a fairly direct attitude with those we advise and to head them off from any idea that they can play games in the investment market, which generally they don't understand, and short the business to try to get their share price working?
I think I'd agree with what you said. Thanks, Andrew. Maybe there's a misunderstanding. I was saying shorting the share market, not your own position. So I don't think I'd...
I think even shorting the share market is a pretty grim idea.
I'm not necessarily advocating it. I'm just floating it out there as an idea. It's thinking outside the box.
Now, others, maybe on that issue there, I think it's just an example of thinking if you've got a risk in, for example, the personal mortgage insurance that in an economic downturn your business is likely to sustain losses, is there some type of risk management approach that you can adopt which is likely to deliver profits in exactly that circumstance? Okay, and then shorting the equity market was an example Brett had of something that may do that. There may be other things you can think of. It's just really the approach of thinking, well, what am I actually exposed to? And then what tools are available that may help my business if those situations eventuate?
If I can just say, I'm an investor, and I wouldn't expect to hold more than 2% of my wealth in any of your shares, and I'll do my hedging at those risks. Thank you very much. I really don't want you doing that.
That's one view.
Yeah.
Take up that theme. Why wouldn't you short the property market instead? If you think you're net long on property and you want to be neutral, then you'd short the property market, not equities. You've got a huge basis risk if you short equities instead of property. And as to whether that's justifiable or not, it's only the same as using cat bonds if you're a general insurer and using them to offset your cat risk, isn't it? You've got a basis risk issue. But the question is, what's the closest match you can find in the market?
Thanks, Nathan. I'd agree with that. I suppose I just discounted the option of using property and shorting property because it's probably something that's illiquid, hard to trade. Maybe as a long-term stake you could do that in that situation. I just used the example of equities to be a bit controversial.
It worked.
And to demonstrate the basis risk that in a lot of these cases. So I agree. In a perfect world, that would be a better hedge. In practice, whether it's possible, who knows. I mean, one example might be, just following on from that, if you were an LMI as part of a group, there may be some way of internally hedging the business so that you had effectively a short position from another part, maybe a fund management operation.
Brett Stewart, Crockett. I think you've covered something quite important. I think for 99% of people working in financial institutions, the real problem with risk management is it's boring.
Yeah.
It's like sitting at the airport watching planes land, and it only gets interesting when one crashes. And it is boring most of the time. I like to think of it more of a wine appreciation society. And it's the way we're trying to sort of think about it. I think it makes a difference. You sort of all sit round, and because everyone's taking the risk, you all taste the wine. We've tended too often, I think, to get to a point where we've analysed the underlying parts, or even worse, we said to the Wine Appreciation Society, we will bring in the chief risk manager who knows everything about what's going on, and that person will quaff the wine down and tell us how good or bad it is. I think the real positive for me of all this is the title of the presentation around capturing the upside. There is upside here. We do think about it as being very negative and very boring. I think if we can start thinking about it as how we're value rather than this, diminish value, I think that's a useful. So thanks for that, Brett.
Thank you. I think that's what I try to address. A few things where how you define ERM, how you do certain things. Just focus on the commercial benefits.
Okay, we've got to move on to our other sessions, so I'd just like to everyone to